me? Is it me? Am I the guy? Am I the guy right now? I don't know. We're doing a weird thing.
I guess you're the guy. We didn't really figure out who's going to intro here.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm out on the road. I'm putting sunscreen on the kid because we're sitting in like 8,000 feet of elevation and somewhere in Utah next to a military base. So I've got cell phone service. I don't really know what's going
on. That's right.
Now I'm like dying from fumes from the
thing. I see that. Yeah,
but that's for mood. That's like a mood thing. We're all set now. You know,
we are. Well, regardless, welcome to Overcrest.
Hey,
I'm Jake.
It's great to be here. I'm Chris. This is my first time.
Yes.
This is my first time being on a podcast. It's great.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming
on. No problem.
So you're currently gallivanting across the United States.
Yes.
Once again.
Yeah.
In the 9/11. And it feels so good, I'm sure, to be reunited.
It is.
Back where this seems like your happy place, especially driving in the Southwest.
Yeah, I'm sure we can talk about that. We'll do like a full recap. I don't want to...
Well, right. So next week, we'll do a full recap on the experiences of Luftgekühlt that I missed out on.
Yeah,
as
you
well
did.
As
yeah, you did. What a,
across
what
the country.
A mistake.
I know.
You foolish man.
Foolish man, yeah. Indeed. Yes, but I have a different episode this week. And I wanted to ask you a question before we get into it.
Okay.
And that we talked about this several times before. Electric cars are the future.
Yes.
And that's inevitable and it's fine. But what does this mean for us driving our classic cars? What are we concerned about?
Well, there's a lot of different facets to this. Obviously, the long-term concern, I mean, there's a lot of concerns, okay? So there's concerns about, just broadly, will we be able to drive them, right? That's kind of the overarching concern. Also, who are we going to hand them down to? Who's going to care? Who gives a shit, right? That's another concern.
Yeah. I want to get more into your concern that someone is going to take your keys away and tell you you can't drive. What does that hypothetical look like to you, and what is that concern?
That will never happen until
what I'm... What is the future of motoring?
Come and take it. That's all I mean, that's good luck. Come and take it.
From my cold, dead hands.
For me, if there was like a Second Amendment, but like 2.5, and it was like, okay. And it was like this is just as important to me as the firearms I have in my safe. And that
probably more so for your lifestyle.
I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the freedom of autonomy and the freedom to the freedom to travel, go where I want, when I want. I feel like we're slowly slipping into this almost dystopian world where everything's, I feel like it's just like, I don't know. I don't want to get, obviously, this isn't like a political thing. I'm trying to decide if it is.
No, and we're going to stay away from politics in this episode.
Yeah, okay, yeah, for sure. But I still feel like societally, and not I feel like urban planning, society, everything is kind of condensing down into like this urban feel where everything's easier because you live in the city. You don't have to go anywhere. You can like have everything delivered. You know, you can work from home. And, you know, they're doing all kinds of things where they're like, making it so you can't build any more parking garages downtown. Like they don't want, nobody wants, no urban planner wants cars. No, none. No, right. No modern urban planner thinks cars are a good idea.
Ironically, I remember reading a study that working from home over the pandemic has made a lot of people shift and move away from urban areas in the city because you're able to do that.
Yeah.
But yes, to your point, like we're moving towards the point where we want to basically have people living in these ideal communities, they don't need cars. And what that's going to turn into then is, I think we're concerned about eventually either regulations or cost prohibitive factors that you won't be able to drive the car you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's, there's, in America at least, I mean, if you look at what's going on in Europe, they're doing all kinds of things. You can't drive your car.
They're already
there. You can't drive your car here, you can't drive your car there. Taxes are $1 million. You think there's a lot of gas tax in California, which is like $1 per gallon is taxes. You should go to Europe, go to like Belgium where it's, I don't know what amount is, $1 million. I don't know. It's cost prohibitive. And there's a reason that in certain places that EV adoption is much higher just because it becomes so difficult to maintain the status quo of combustion engine. It just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't. And there'll be a point where I will be like, for my daily driver, I'm not going to deal with it.
Right.
I'm just not. I'm not going to deal with it.
So here's what we have for the episode, Chris. Okay. You won't be on because you're going to be driving, but we have our official, unofficial Overcrest legal division coming on.
Okay.
Mr. Dave
Aubrey. Oh, I love that guy.
And he's going to talk to us about what the ramifications of these concerns are and if it's likely. Like, are we going to see something like in the UK in the future where we won't be able to drive our cars where we want? And
to be fair,
so we're going to talk about the legality.
To be fair, the UK doesn't have a, like, the US Constitution. The US Constitution is a very unique document. You know, it is a very unique document that affords a lot of liberties. And I mean, it's kind of been eroded.
Well, it's a good thing I'm talking to a lawyer then.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been eroded over the last, you know, however many years, 250 years or whatever it is. Oh, God, there's some bad math there. How long is this going to
last? Also,
how long have we been around?
We
20 years.
Yeah, we don't need to go there. 1770.
Yeah, well, I know that, but I was trying to do the math. It was like 260 years.
Also have our ever vivacious friend Joel Fetter coming on as well.
As soon as you said vivacious,
to talk about
I knew exactly
where I was going. To talk about kind of the state of the industry, he's plugged right in with manufacturers and all the new cars coming out to kind of see, because my first concern was, well, yes, EVs make a lot of sense, but they don't make sense for everyone. And so we're going to have a cool conversation about what about middle America and the farmers out there? And how does the EV laws and regulations, how is that going to affect them?
Oh, they'll be just so, like, hold on. Just think about how the, like, if you, there's always special rules for that, right? Like, you can drive around in a farm truck that's not registered, just has farm plates on it, right? And you can, if you're 13 years old, you can drive around.
Farm plate 911.
Farm plate 911. There you go. Haul around some barley and oats in the front trunk. But you can also, like, 13, 14 years old, you can drive. Right. Yes, so there's all these kind of like special like agricultural rules to make sure that those guys, because I mean, it's pretty important, all that stuff. It's like critical infrastructure. So they will figure out a way to make that work as like a stopgap till technology catches up with it. It'll make sense for them. But that's not really what I'm worried about. I'm worried about, like I said, I'm worried about the shift away from personal autonomy and individual liberty that goes with being able to travel when you want, how you want, and where you want. And like I said, this right here, this is just as important as the Second Amendment, being able to do this, being able to travel, you know, getting locked down to a bus because you can't afford an EV. That's not freedom.
Should we have Dave work on drafting a new amendment that
we should
put Overcrest weight behind? The right to bear vehicle or something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The right to bear vehicle. I think we could probably come up with something better than that. I think it would be the right to travel. You know, the right to go where you want, when you want, how you want. You know, it's a big place, and
but it is the car that makes that possible, because they'll say, great, you can hop on the train, you can hop on
but
a
you
bus,
can't,
or you can take one of the EV rides.
Yeah, but you can't, because you can't go where you want, when you want, how you want, because there's a schedule. It only goes to certain places. It can be controlled. They can say who can go on the train or not go on the train based on your social credit score. Oh, sorry, you can't go on the train. And if you think I'm crazy, this shit exists in the world. Don't look at me like I'm nuts. This exists.
No, I know. But yes, you're talking about China's social credit
score. Well, there's other places that do these things. And if you look at the arc of human history, these things aren't that foreign. And you think that, like, this civilization and America and everything that's been here, we've been here forever. Oh my gosh. No, we haven't. It's been like 250 years. Before that was just misery, oppression, and destitute. You were in destitution. So if you think that we can't somehow go back to that, you're out of your mind. You know, we have to be very careful with how we operate here. And if you look at American history, one of the reasons why it was so great is because people could just, you know, flow out of the East Coast and go across the country and make their way, right? Freedom to do it. So if we start taking that away from people, so we can...
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Right. Yeah, I suppose that's probably a little bit of that, huh? And how are you supposed to do that?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of...
Good roads. How are you supposed to pursue anything if you have to take the bus?
Ooh, I like that. That's a t-shirt. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of good
Yeah,
roads.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of not taking the bus. How are you supposed to get out of a food desert or like a job, like an area that has no jobs if you don't have a car? Like, what are you right. supposed to do as like a lower income individual that's stuck somewhere? Are you going to ride the Muni for like 7 hours round trip? Who's going to watch your kids? Are you even going to be able to have kids?
No, Chris, you live and you work in the fifth wall.
Okay? Yeah, right. That's where you're supposed exactly to be. That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Little homage to Chris's novel there. Okay. Well, you need to get back on the road and we need to get to our experts.
Yeah, did you work this much on the road trip with Irene? And I'm not working a lot, but...
Oh, is that what she said?
So she's mad at me right now. Are you... Hey, Vern, are you upset with me right now?
Yes, very.
Okay, there you go.
Hi, Vern. Okay, well, you better get going. Are you... You're on the... it looks like you're on the extraterrestrial highway.
I'm on Highway 80.
Judging by your daughter's plushie.
Yes, we did visit the extraterrestrial highway. We did. We'll talk about that later. Right now, I'm in a quote-unquote military area, which is probably why the cell phone service is so good.
That's true. Yes. All right. Well, we're going to get on to our experts with the future of motoring and what Chris doesn't actually have to worry about.
Wait, what? I hope you're right.
This whole episode is going to be why you're wrong. And this isn't
reality.
Well,
you didn't tell me that. It is a reality. What are you talking about? It's already happening around the world.
All right. Well, stay tuned in why that's not going to be a concern here.
I have no way to respond. You're going to tell me. Exactly. All right, guys. I can't wait to tell you guys some stories. I hope you guys enjoy Dave Aubrey. Great dude. And I read some of the emails that I was kind of chained in on this episode.
We were going back and
forth. It's going to be super interesting. I hope everybody enjoys it.
All right. Take care, Chris. We'll talk to you next week. All right. Before we get into it, let's hear from our sponsor about Automotive Anonymous. What started out as a personal collector of motorsports goods has turned into an amazing curated store of vintage automotive posters and collectibles. And being a Porsche enthusiast, Automotive Anonymous has hundreds of products, not only from Porsche, but also all sorts of awesome old motorsport decor. All the posters featured on the site are original, with many extremely rare pieces, and the unique enamel pins are all limited edition. Inventory is updated every month with vintage motorsport apparel, books, models, and other collectibles coming soon. Be sure to check them out at autoanon.com or on Instagram at Automotive Anonymous. And use the code OVERCREST to get free shipping on any and all of your posters. Check them out. Some really cool stuff out there. I really need to buy the 951 poster if it's still available, unless someone else scooped it up. Because it is the red car that I have in my garage right now. So it's a great site, really cool stuff to check out. And I really like the guy behind it as well. He puts a lot of work into valuing these posters very fairly. So like I said, check those guys out. All right, let's get into it. Mr. Dave Aubrey, the official unofficial Overcrest Legal Division. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to give you my pro bono efforts to make the world better.
Well, hopefully it's pro bono. Otherwise, we're going to be looking for a large bill, I imagine. But being an actual expert in the law, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of our concerns regarding, you know, the future of motoring and electric vehicles and autonomy in general and what that means for kind of driving freedom. And you actually sent us a really great email, which preempted this entire episode. So last week when we were chatting with Joel Fetter, we mentioned kind of the potential concern of government policy forcing electric vehicles on consumers. Now, assumedly, from what little I know, this would be the EPA or the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that would force these policies potentially. So if you could, please kind of school us a little bit on the legal structure and how it pertains to this and what that would look like.
Right. So it really flows out of the, you know, the U.S. Constitution and those three federal branches and their functions. And just like your Schoolhouse Rock level explanation is the legislature, they make the laws, the executive enforces them, and then the judges interpret them. And so the interplay there, though, has been complex, to say the least, you know, in our 200 some years of being a country. And so where it gets interesting, you know, Chris was talking about, like, I think he said, like, what is the EPA? Like, how does it get its authority? Maybe it was a question I thought I heard. And so I was like, well, I'll just answer that in an email. Basically, a lot of times when Congress writes a law, it will put in the law the authority to the executive to have agencies implement the law. Sort of like, so the senators are saying, we're not experts, but your agencies that work for the president, you have a bunch of scientists and, you know, lawyers and doctors working for you there that are nonpartisan. You guys figure out how to do this. And so the law itself will say, hey, executive, you do this. And so the Clean Air Act is really specific, and it not only tells, you know, the executive to set things up and make these regulations, but it says, you know, any challenges just have to be at the court in DC too. So, you know, I live in St. Louis, so I couldn't file here in the federal court. If I wanted to challenge those regulations, it has to be in DC. So then it goes pretty much straight to the Supreme Court from there for review. But what the agency does then is, okay, we have a new law and we need to figure out how to implement it. Congress told us to. And so there is something called the Federal Register that has been around since 1935 or so. And it publishes potential regulations. And then we all have, it's assumed that we've read them and agree with them. And you then they're implemented.
Have you?
Yeah. I have before, like in my practice, when it impacts my clients, I've submitted comments. And actually, they came out in my favor. Like, they did what I asked, actually. But that's what lobbyists are looking at. And they're letting their interested clients know, hey, you want to comment on this? You have 90 days or whatever. And then once it's published as the new code, that's the regulation. And that also includes executive orders. So that's what an executive order is. It goes into those regulations. And, you know, as soon as a president changes parties, it all changes. Right.
Right.
And
I suppose.
Yeah. So that's sort of the overview of how that happens. And ultimately, though, the Supreme Court is the one that can, you know, decide, hey, you know, this was either a constitutional law or the executive isn't, you know, properly implementing it. So those are the questions, right?
Sure. Okay. So, you know, in the email, you talked a little bit about how the judicial branch decides if the other two branches are adhering to the Constitution. And this is where kind of a little interesting history nugget came up.
Yep.
And in 1952, Harry Truman was worried about the supply of steel to fight the Korean War. And this turned into basically a landmark case that does kind of pertain to this. Mm-hmm. So if I may, I'll give a little background on what this case was.
Absolutely.
Feel free to jump in anytime I'm wrong or don't have the facts right or elaborate as needed, please, because I'm not the expert. That's why we have you on. So the United States was involved in the Korean War in 1950. And unlike what was done in World War II, President Truman did not choose to impose price controls. So instead, in kind of a vast effort to stabilize the economy and inflation during wartime, they created a so-called wage stabilization board that sought to keep down the inflation of consumer prices and wages. But it didn't really work at all. In fact, the United States Steelworkers of America rejected this board's proposal and the wage increases and threatened to go on strike. And this would have had huge implications during wartime. You know, it turns out you need a lot of steel to fight a war. You need guns, tanks, and planes, and they're pretty necessary, and they all use steel. So because of this, and fearing severe interruption, not only into like wartime supply and infrastructure, but also the effects of kind of damaging the entire domestic economy, President Truman decided to simply take control of steel production facilities and place the plants under federal direction. Right. Now, keep in mind that this was done entirely via an executive order, like we were mentioning. Truman didn't go to Congress to obtain any permission. Instead, it was considered a response to a national emergency, quote unquote.
Right.
And this was apparently a complete surprise to the steel industry executives. I read that Truman announced his plans on a nationally televised and radio broadcast address. And within minutes, of the president's address going off the air, steel company attorneys were knocking on the door, literally, of the home of one Judge Walter M. Bastian. So the Honorable Mr. Bastian sat on the Washington, D.C. District Court and would be able to issue a temporary restraining order, keeping these steel plants out of government hands. And this is kind of where things get messy. So the hearing, again, this is my cursory knowledge of it. The hearing was appointed to a Truman-appointed judge who it basically went as well as you could expect on the initial hearing of that. The case was then assigned to a judge by the name of David Andrew Pine. And this Judge Pine supposedly realized that this wasn't a case about a labor dispute or steel mills at all. It was, at its core, a fundamental issue of presidential power. Right. So the court set aside 5 hours for oral arguments and allowed the steelworkers and the railroad unions to speak as amicus curiae. Now, Dave, do you know that term? Can you care to explain to the class?
Amicus curiae.
Thank you. I knew my Latin wasn't very good with pronunciation.
It means you're a friend of the court. And so if there's a major issue going before any appellate court in pretty much any state or the federal courts, you're going to have parties watching it. We'll file a brief that, you know, says, hey, this is why you should rule this way. And so, you know, I'm a trial lawyer for people who get hurt. And so we will often comment, you know, on pending appellate things and say, hey, this is what we think it should be. And then the other side will, you know, have their own. It's an amicus brief is what it's called.
Okay. So are these people like requested by the court to come in and give, you know, their expertise, or is it something where you say, oh, this is an important case that I know something about, I'm going to submit kind of an opinion on it?
It could be both. The court could ask for that. But yeah, typically it's just going to be like interested parties will comment.
Got it. Okay. So before an overflowing courtroom crowd, this individual, a prominent lawyer and a politician at the time, John W. Davis, he argued for the steel companies that the president had no power to make laws or more particularly to seizure property without congressional authorization. And in fact, the Supreme Court concluded that, quote, the president had no power to act except in those cases that are expressly or implicitly authorized by the Constitution or as an act of Congress. And within minutes of the court's ruling, the steel mills were ordered to be returned to their owners, and the steelworkers subsequently went on strike shortly thereafter, which I find kind of ironic, I guess. The exact thing they were trying not to do, well, this is what the court says, so right there. The strike lasted for more than 50 days, apparently, and the factories were shut down. Luckily, however, there existed a large stockpile of raw steel throughout the country, which, of course, kind of undercut the president's claim that this was a national emergency in the first place. So in the end, Truman was kind of shocked by the court's decision. And I'll just end it with this fun little anecdote that I read. So Justice Black, he was the one who wrote the opinion for the court. And he was so worried about kind of the political ramifications and backlash about, you know, kind of throwing this on Truman, that he decided to smooth the feathers over and basically reach out an olive branch with some good old-fashioned Southern hospitality. He invited the president, along with all of his fellow justices, to a party at his home. And the gesture worked. Truman, still upset from the defeat, told Black, quote, Hugo, I don't much care for your law. By golly, this bourbon sure is good. So, wow. Dave, that's all well and good, right? But what does that mean for the future of motoring? How does that really pertain to our concerns here?
First of all, I'll compliment you. That was better than any law professor taught it, I think.
But well, thank you.
Legally, what you're saying, and I'm going to use that story now. Legally, what you're seeing throughout history is the executive gets so powerful, and Congress keeps giving the executive power still. And the Supreme Court's stopping it. And it really was a remarkable thing to think I can seize steel plants.
I mean, when I was reading that, and we won't get into politics, we'll shy away from that, but you think of that and you go, that seems ridiculous right. that in the US they could just seize an entire a corporation, but also just an industry as a whole. Like there's multiple companies that were all working here.
Yep. Yep. And so I think it was a really good ruling. And then there's language in there that Justice Black wrote that talks about the ebb and flow of a presidential authority. So it's the lowest when he's acting on his own. And that comes back up later in the cases from like Guantanamo Bay and in some of the Iraq War Supreme Court opinions that they look back and they looked, you know, did just Judge Bush have congressional authority or not Judge Bush, President Bush, obviously have authority when he did these things. And they found, you know, Congress had given him that and hadn't implemented some treaties. So it's an interesting language. And that's what the Supreme Court does is it takes its old language and applies it to new things and says these are similar circumstances. And so, yeah, that's it's a really good case. But it's one every law student learns. So.
Okay. So circling back to the EPA then specifically, you mentioned also that in 1984, there was kind of another landmark case that circled around or basically pertained to the EPA's power specifically. And so this is called the Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council case. So I looked into this case and it's a bit more complicated legally speaking. So I'll just give kind of like a quick intro and let you take it from there if you would and explain what this really means.
That's fine.
So the Environmental Protection Agency, aka the EPA, had previously set forth the Clean Air Act. And this was a wide-reaching set of regulations that were aimed at controlling carbon emissions, both from the obvious, that being of cars, but also from different industries, right? Then, in 1977, Congress amended the Clean Air Act. At issue was the fact that there were many states who had not met the standards that had originally been set forth. The new amendment required these non-compliant states to establish a sort of permit program regulating sources of air pollution. The problem, as I understood it then, was kind of the ambiguity of these so-called permits, right?
Yep.
So what happened next with that?
Yeah, so there are rules for judges to interpret statutes, like you look at the language, and if it means more than one thing, like a clause, that's called ambiguity legally. And so—
Okay, so I even used the correct term legally then.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a term of art too.
Sometimes I get accidentally smart, Dave.
Yeah, it's great. It's good stuff.
All right, yeah, so we have legal ambiguity, right, specifically in this Clean Air Act amendment.
And so what the legal ambiguity is interesting, and it's because it's one where the political stuff switched sides over 40 years too. The ambiguity was whether a plant was new construction, and that was the only plant that could be regulated, or it was a remodel. So say you have a refinery and you're adding another cat cracker or a tank farm or whatever, or powerhouse, is that a new, you know, construction?
So basically, would you need these permits that they're requiring for these new things? Okay.
So you could opt out. Say you're in Louisiana and you already have like 100 refineries there or something, or Texas. And, you know, if it's only for new construction, that's really significant, right? Because you already got that infrastructure.
Right. So there's a huge loophole, basically.
So the Reagan administration said, you know, you got to defer to us, you know, give our agencies deference. And, you know, we interpret it this way, which is it's for only brand new plants.
Okay.
And so at the time, it was a win for industry.
Sure.
Because it, you know, it narrowed the scope of regulation. But what happened is the Chevron test, which is two prongs, it says, first, is the statute ambiguous? And if you say yes, then you say, well, if it has, you know, if Congress has, or sorry, if the agency has a rational sort of basis for its interpretation of the statute, then you defer to them. So because, you know, they're the experts, we're going to defer to the agency. And so in practice, that has been really helpful for environmental groups that sue the EPA in the last 40 years. So it was sort of like they won the refineries won the big first battle, but then they've been losing the war on that one.
Interesting. Yeah, and I should mention, so it's called the Chevron versus National Resource Defense, because Chevron was, of course, one of the companies that was affected by this. So they actually brought this case to the Supreme Court.
Yep. A group of them. So this Chevron rule is what we call it. And, you know, everyone knows it's referring to deference to an agency by, you know, a judge.
So explain that again. What does that actually mean?
Yeah,
it pertains to, like, I don't know, new regulations today.
Well, let's pretend like this. Like, so say you're a judge, Jake, and I'm in your court and I'm saying, hey, this agency did the wrong thing. They shouldn't be looking at my plant because it's just a remodel, right?
Okay.
And you say, well, yeah, what do you say, EPA? And they say, listen, we're the experts. We have the scientists. You need to defer to us. You as a judge will look and say, okay, this is what Congress said. And it looks like the EPA did the right thing. So Dave, you lose, right? That's how it happens in the real world. And then your decision, if it sticks, you know, all the way to the Supreme Court, then that's the law.
So basically what I'm getting out of this is the EPA, because of this, almost has more power. Is that correct or no?
Yeah, it's been successful for environmental regulation for a long time. That's what the test. And I think I looked up some statistics on it. At lower levels, you know, like there's three sort of tiers for judges. You have the trial judge who's, you know, sitting in the cities across the country. And then above them, there are circuit judges that review their decisions. And then above that tier is the Supreme Court that reviews the circuit decisions. So they all have authority in their areas. And then the Supreme Court has authority over everything, right? I lost my train of thought a little bit there, but sorry.
No, that's all right. What I want to circle back into, you know, with the way that these laws work and the way that we're basically taking a detailed look at the process, you know, if the EPA came and said, you can't drive gasoline powered cars anymore, period.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a reasonable concern that we should have as automotive enthusiasts from a legal perspective?
Right. And that's what I lost my train of thought there, and I'll get right to that. So the appellate judges and the trial judges tend to give deference to the agencies, but when it's at the Supreme Court, not much. And so and there are vocal judges at the Supreme Court that want Chevron test gone. Like they say, so yeah, there's 9 Supreme Court justices. So every time they vote, you need to get 5 of them, right?
Right.
And so they've already carved out EPA authority. There was a regulation that both Obama and Trump did to coal plants, right? So Trump made it a little broader, but they both had implemented this. And the Supreme Court sort of made an exception to the Chevron test and said, no, you can't regulate these coal plants in West Virginia. So that was West Virginia v. EPA. That was just decided last year. And so right now for cars, the EPA, what it's doing is it's saying to the automakers, you have to have such a small amount of tailpipe emissions that effectively only electric cars could be the new cars you make. That's the way they're trying to do it. But the question is, that's a regulation that the EPA has promulgated that you could comment on now if you want to. But the question is what the courts are going to do, you know? And I personally, if I'm guessing, I don't think this Supreme Court's going to let that regulation stand, right?
No.
If, you know, like if they're not doing it for coal plants in West Virginia, I don't think they're going to force Detroit to make a certain type of car. I just don't see it.
Interesting.
But that's, you know, that's my speculation. So
we've looked at some of like the European countries, and you look at like in certain city centers, they're completely banning, you know, gasoline cars. Period.
Yep. Yep.
Do you see that perhaps that could be a step towards this? Where let's say, within St. Louis proper or within Minneapolis proper, it's electric vehicles only, zero CO2 emission tailpipe.
Yeah, I think that that's possible in some cities and some states. And I think European law is a whole other thing that could really impact the market, you know, because like I look at the Audi electric cars and they look great. Like,
sure,
you know,
yeah.
You know, so that may drive it. But if in the United States, to answer your question specifically, so if you're in a state where the cities match the alignment of the politics, that's possible, right? Like, so Seattle, right? Boston, places where the city can maybe make that rule and it won't get overturned. But here in St. Louis, I don't think Jefferson's gonna let that stand. Like, if they banned, you know, that I just, they overturn the voters here all the time. So,
interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, getting back to the initial, I'll make fun of Chris a little bit. You know, he said, his concern ultimately is like someone prying the keys from his cold, dead hands for his 911 that they say, you can't drive this anymore. And it's interesting because you finished your email, allude to this a little bit in the sense that it may not even be laws that ultimately lead to that. It's more, the financial markets and, you know, the economy itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. You know, like, if refineries, because refinery capacity in the U.S. has already been going down, you know, they're just choosing to make less. And I don't know why. So that, you know, if Shell says we are done refining oil, okay, what am I going to do? You know, that's not an easy, like, homebrew thing you can do, you know. So,
yeah, and it's interesting because we've heard from a couple different manufacturers, Porsche being one of them, this talk about e-fuels or these synthetic fuels. And the kind of saving grace of them, I think in the EPA's eyes especially, is the fact that they're made via recaptured carbon.
Yeah.
So in a sense, they have zero net emissions or like carbon impact, carbon footprint.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we certainly could see that potentially filling that gap.
Yeah.
But then how expensive will that be compared to, you know, a gas, a premium or a gallon of premium today? So A, you have the legal ramifications. B, you kind of have the financial implications. At what point is it untenable to drive our classic cars?
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting thought, and I'm glad we were able to kind of get through to some of the legal issues concerning it. And I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I will say one last thing that Chris and I thought, you know, you had talked about, being able to kind of give your opinions on some of these laws and especially with the EPA.
Yeah.
We want to propose that the Overcrest legal division, aka you, should somehow create a new constitutional amendment called the right to bear vehicles.
Yes. Okay? Yeah.
And so it's like life, liberty, and the pursuit of good roads.
Right. Right.
So I think you need to start working on that and drafting that in the background, and we'll push for that.
I would love that. Let's do it.
Awesome. So, well, thank you. Thank you, Dave. This has been illuminating, and hopefully the EPA won't be coming for our cars anytime soon.
I don't think they will. I don't think it's going to make it, but you know, that the market might change things, but yeah, I think we're safe. Chris can sleep it safe at night.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jake.
Okay. So next up, as we discuss kind of the future of motoring freedom and its implications, I wanted to talk to none other than Joel Fetter, who is in the industry, kind of has a pulse on manufacturers, what's coming down the pike for new models and kind of where that brings us. And so before we get our daily dose of audible amphetamines from the ever enthusiastic Joel, let's take a minute to hear from our sponsor, Petrolbox. Petrolbox, as you guys know, it's a monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiasts. Each month, they carefully select items including tools, detailing supplies, apparel, garage gear, stickers, publications, all the rest to be sent right there to your doorstep. It's a curated selection of the latest and greatest gear in the industry, and there's actually two different levels of subscription to choose from. You have the Petrobox Basic, which costs less than $20 a month, while the Petrobox Premium gets you even more gear for $39.95 a month. Check them out at mypetrolbox.com. And of course, be sure to use the code OVERCREST at checkout to get $6 off your first month. All right, let's get to Mr. Joel Fetter. Mr. Joel Fetter, welcome.
Mr. Jake.
So we're here talking about the future of motoring and motoring freedom, and you're tapped into the industry, and you know what's going on. So I thought we'd go to the source and talk to you.
I note that we're doing this without Chris. Seems right.
Yes, we are. Exactly. Because as we know, Chris is always concerned about someone like telling him he can't drive his car and that they're going to steal his keys and it's going to be either illegal or untenable to drive, you know, this old classic gas-powered car that we have. And what's truly an issue, as he stated it,
man.
I know, but that hasn't ever been a factor where EVs are going to be the norm, right? Everything's going
EVs are totally going to be the norm, yeah.
Yeah, that's acceptable. We know that. And it makes sense for most people most of the time. Right. But he's concerned, being Chris. We had a little intro here while he was on the road. And he was concerned about the shift away from personal autonomy, right? If you can only drive an EV, that means that people aren't going to have as easy access to getting in the car and going anywhere. So
I don't agree with that.
Okay, why not?
Well, I mean, at a high level, right now, you or me or any general consumer doesn't have a gas station in their house, right? So
okay,
you can't refuel your house. You're not leaving your house with a full tank of fuel, right?
Sure.
In EV, you will always, it's like plugging in a cell phone. You will always leave your house, or you can always leave your house with a full tank of fuel. And hang on, in the case of, so that's like in that sense, right? When it comes to adventuring or going on the less beaten path, the Cleewell way,
like whatever non-road Chris is on right now,
right? And I'm going to take a step further. Let's say you're not in a 911,
okay,
doing things you shouldn't be doing, but like you're legitimately going off road. You're really going off the beaten path, right? I think down the road there will be solutions, because automakers like Jeep, right? Jeep is very in tune with their Wrangler owners. And I mean very in tune. Few automakers understand their demographic better than someone like Jeep or Subaru or whatever. Like, they are in tune with their market, right? And Jeep knows that Wrangler owners go off-road. They go to the steep Moab, and they go off-roading on rocks, and they go through sand. They know this, right? And so they designed – and they've already shown, and I'm sure it's like iteration one, right? But they've shown solar-powered chargers, and they've actually been in their commercials too, right? Where you could just, they could put a charger, and then when you're off-roading, it'll be powered by solar, right? Like, they'll have a battery, and it'll be, like, the battery will charge via solar and sit there, and the little you plug in your car, it'll charge, and you keep going, right? Rivian is building out their charging network. And while they're doing some of it in cities or whatever, a big part of their plans, because their vehicles are built for adventures and places that are exploring, a big part of their plan calls for putting chargers on the less beaten path. A big part of their plan calls for putting charging stations in the middle of nowhere, in parks, at trailheads, etc., right? Place you're leaving your car and you're going to hike for a couple hours, right? It makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
And this is today. I mean, imagine 5 years from now. Right? Like 10 years from now.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is that the EV infrastructure will be there to the point where this won't be an issue.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to someone, it doesn't matter who, and they didn't know a lot about electric cars. They didn't know a lot about the future of electrification. They weren't a car person. Sure. And they were asking me a bunch of questions about EVs and electrification and the future and all that stuff. And I just gave them factual answers, not even opinion-based answers, just factual answers through everything. And at the end of the conversation, this person looked to me unprompted and said, man, like a decade from now, we're all going to look back and think, man, we were all pretty dumb to complain or like think that, oh my God, we're going to have to spend $1,000 or $1,500 to put a charger in our home, when all of a sudden it's like, yeah, but we charge our cars like our cell phones and we just refuel in our house. Like, she's like, we're going to all look back at everything we're all worried about today in a decade from now and we're going to laugh at this. And I'm like, quite possible. Probably okay, possible, so
that,
right? Like,
that assumes that everyone is going to have an electric car then.
Not everyone will have an electric car. Yeah, in a decade from now. No way.
Okay. But what about gas stations? Here's my thought. If we have the electrical charging network, and it makes sense that they'll be where people are, and you can go off on these adventures, and there'll be a charging network there or a station there.
By the way, that's only talking about people like Chris who are going on adventures,
sure,
right? Like,
yes. For
the average American driver, 40 miles a day.
Right. And it makes sense that when you pull up to Target to do your errands, you'll just plug in there, right? We understand that makes sense. But what that means is gas stations as a business model, there won't be as many gas stations. You won't be able to pump gas because there won't be a need for it. Simply from an economy scale, right? So again, that goes back to the fact that, okay, my old 911 or my C10 or any of your 300, like, are you not going to be able to find gas as easily to go and drive that car?
Not in the short term you're talking about by any means, right? Because electric trucking, like talking about trucking industry, right? Electric trucking, which is like last mile stuff. Not talking like Amazon delivery and USPS and UPS and that stuff, right? That kind of last mile stuff is already in the transition, right? Hmm. But I'm talking last mile, like Walmart having a semi pull up. That kind of last mile. That stuff is going to take longer when it's not something like Frito-Lay doing a 500-mile run with bags of chips that weigh nothing. When you're talking about moving heavy equipment and big loads that weigh a lot, that last mile in terms of 18-wheelers and semis, that's going to take a minute, right? So, and I also don't think – and again, by the way, some of this stuff is opinion, right? And this changes over time as you witch things. It's my opinion it's going to take a minute because – so as I'm answering this, I'm going to explain other things. So like Shell, one of the largest petroleum companies in the world, something around – I think they – I don't remember the study, but they basically released data about a year ago-ish. We wrote about this in Green Car Reports. And they basically said that by the data, oil consumption – gas consumption, right?
Right.
Basically peaked in 2017. Like, you will never be that high again. Yep. We're already in the decline. It's happening.
Was
consumption
that,
worldwide.
Was that because of COVID we declined then after 2017? Or why? What was 2017?
Remember, globally speaking, right? So, because China and Europe are way ahead of us on electrification, right?
Sure.
And you got India, who is like three decades behind us in their industrial revolution. So, but they're a smaller country, right? But they're a smaller country, so their impact will be less as they consume more oil, right? And also, as their industrial revolution comes, they might skip a generation or two and go straight to the electric stuff, right? Like, it's possible. So you got two countries. Let's say China, Asia, us, and Europe are, like, let's just say, the three largest first world countries or continent areas, right?
Or markets, we'll say.
If two of those are already farther along than us, Shell is the one saying that in 2017, our oil consumption peaked. By the way, 2017 was 3 years before COVID, 4 years before COVID, long before COVID.
I know. That's why I was trying to make sense of it.
And by the way, it might have been 2018. I might have the number wrong. But like, it was years ago. Like, years ago.
Okay.
That they basically – and this was a study that came out about a year ago. So this wasn't years ago they said this. This was about a year ago they said this. But they're aware of it. And they know.
So what are they doing?
There's already a transition going on.
They have to – be super concerned.
They already are. So they bought the charging network called Volta. It's a smaller charging network. It's not nearly as large as Electrify America or EVgo or anything like that. But they bought Volta about a year ago, might have been like 9 months ago. So they bought a charging network. There's only one Volta station, if I remember correctly, in Minnesota. It's in Lakeville. Because I look at where the charging networks are and all that stuff for us, right?
Yeah, no, I just
but we do have one Volta in Minnesota charging station, and they're now owned by Shell. Shell purchased them, so they bought their own charging network that was already started. It's small, but 7-Eleven came out about a couple months ago saying they're starting a charging network and they want to be one of the large charging networks in the nation, right? Walmart a couple weeks ago said that they're starting their own charging network, not just Electrify America, their own charging network. Because you know what you do when you go to Walmart? You shop. You know what you got to do when you go to Walmart? You got to park.
Yeah.
You know what you go to do Walmart if you're going to charge? probably going to shop and spend money.
Right. No, it makes sense from a business model.
100%. Because
I can't believe that every single one of these organizations is going to have their own. I suppose they don't need their own infrastructure for it. They just need to be able to put their own types of chargers out front and capitalize.
And they don't even need to, right? Like, think of it this way. They can.
Yeah.
Big company like Target or Walmart. Target didn't announce anything. I'm just using it as another big company. Target, Walmart. These are big companies that can afford to build their own chargers or buy their own chargers, put them in front of their stores, right? As an attraction to draw a customer to their store, right? But if you're Target and you're like, I don't care about spending the money, but I still want the charger. So a lot of Targets have Tesla superchargers. They lease part of their parking lot, Tesla superchargers. And they have charge point level twos.
Okay, so that's what I was going to ask, because this shows how little I know about electric cars. So Tesla's supercharger is a proprietary plug, right?
It's a proprietary plug because they developed it long before everyone else. So they're level three. They designed their own charger. They then open sourced their charger, and they actually, the design, and said everyone could use this design. Naturally, no one said we're going to use their design. Everyone else in the world agreed on a different design that is larger and clunkier called CCS. And Tesla wanted some of that sweet, sweet federal money from the Biden administration and all that transportation, like the whole big thing. And so they said, we're going to open part of our charging network. And so they developed what's called the Magic Dock. And they've opened a couple of them, nowhere near us. And the Magic Dock basically, I'm trying to explain this without visual. And you could probably put a link to a Magic Dock. Anyone can Google Magic Dock from Tesla. But basically, it's their plug. But then it's got adapter on it. So what happens is you pull up to a magic plug in a Rivian or anything that's not a Tesla.
Sure.
And basically you go into the app and you say, I'm here. You have to create an account because you own a Tesla. And you say, I'm at stall 5 at the charger station at Hawthorne, right? And I'm in on Tesla. And it says, okay. And it click undoes. And when it comes off, instead of just being the plug for the Tesla, there's an adapter that comes down with it. That's the CCS. Got it. The problem is part of the requirements for the federal dollars are that you have to have a receptacle to take a credit card. Cannot only be app-based.
Sure.
And like a gas pump at the charger.
Yeah.
Tesla said, no. Homie, you're not going to do that. So Tesla basically just lost a whole lot of incentive to open its network to non-Teslas because they're not going to put a credit card, so they're not going to get federal dollars. The whole big thing. So
interesting.
But back to the original point. In the early stages, it's going to be messy. There's going to be all these competing networks. You're going to have all these different apps. But you also can just walk up and just get my credit card, right?
Yeah.
There's also certain states right now that it's required you pay per kilowatt hour. It's like paying for a gallon of gas, right?
Right.
Our state's not one of those states.
Okay, so how does it work?
So if you go to Electrify America charger in Woodbury right now, you pay per kilowatt hour. And there's two different rates. The member rate, if you own an EV, you pay them $4 a month to be subscription, and then you get like 10 cents off per kilowatt hour. It adds up pretty quick if you own an EV, and that makes sense.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But especially if you own like a Hummer or like an F-150 Lightning where you're using like a ton of energy, then it adds up really quick. But something like EVgo, they have a fast charger in Roseville at Target. They charge you per minute. So I went there in a Q4 e-tron.
So it doesn't even matter how much. Okay.
I went there in a Q4 e-tron. And that thing could have been taking 150 kilowatt hours or kilowatts. That could have been the rate pretty quick, reasonably quick. Okay. I plugged in. Their charger was giving me 40 kilowatts. But it was still charging me full price to sit there. Time.
Yep. Yeah. And you're right. Like, I'm sure that'll all become standardized, right?
Oh, 100%. I want Governor Walz to mandate that you got to charge us per kilowatt because that's the right – charges per gallon of gasoline. Why are you charging me for the time?
Yeah, it'll work itself out because no one's going to use that charger. No, that'll 100% work itself out. Right?
And we got really far off topic. The original question you asked.
No, that's okay. One thing I do want to go back to is you talked about India. And I actually wrote down India because I want to talk about the manufacturers creating these vehicles. Right. India, it can't have a robust charging network in place. Not right now and not for years to come. So what cars are manufacturers selling to the India market? They still have to make gasoline cars, right?
Well, so you got to think about like places in the Middle East, places, let's just forget for the interview for a second. Just okay. Think about less developed places in the world.
Right. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. Their safety standards are not nearly what the U.S. is.
Sure.
Right. So they can sell cars that are dirtier emissions wise. They can sell cars that are far less safe. And they can sell cars that cost far less money because they don't need to be as safe. They don't need to be as developed as much or have as much equipment on them. And these people don't care about a 12-inch screen or a 56-inch screen on their dashboard. They're happy their car starts. So
what you're saying is major manufacturers don't care to even market there?
No, what I'm saying is they're not getting the same kind of vehicles we're getting already.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is happening. I'm just as an example to be clear. Honda could sell a Civic that's four generations old there. They could. They're really not doing this. I want to be crystal clear here for anyone calling me on this. But Honda could sell a 4-year-old generation Civic there. They're not going to care. They don't care about having a touchscreen and navigation and all these things. They're a less developed area than us. Well, right? And you go and you go
care
to
about those
like
things either. So
well, but you so America does. You don't.
I
but you go to I've been to Israel. You go to Israel.
Okay.
People are driving like old Mercedes diesels from 10 years ago as taxis.
Right.
That's just the norm.
So another market that I don't think is as well primed for EVs, like, okay, assume that the US, we're working towards the point where it's going to be EVs are the only new car sold here. What is the farmer in the middle of Nebraska going to do who has his old F-150 right now, right? And he's using that thing because he has to tow, you know, the hay bales around or whatever else the case. My point is I can't see the farmer in the middle of Nebraska, the small family farm, buying a Rivian or something to replace his utility truck.
So three things. This is a great topic, by the way, because you don't know this, but my wife's family and my family's history is in agriculture. So I'm well versed on this kind of stuff. So three things. One, you should know farmers, and I mean, this is a big generalization.
Sure.
So this is not all encompassing.
I'll go with it.
Yeah. But generalizing, a lot of farmers drive really nice trucks compared to what you think. And they get replaced very often because they're heavy and they're work vehicles owned by the farm and their taxes write-offs.
Tax, yeah.
So
interesting. Okay.
A lot of farmers are driving $60,000, $70,000 pickups that are a year or two old because
they can. Yeah.
They wrote it off and they're getting beat to shit.
Oh,
Two, you're in the terms of they're living in a desolate place. You use the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, right? It's a good example.
Sure.
Living in a desolate place. A lot of farms have big fuel tanks. And they usually have like an oil one, they have a gas one, and then some of them have propane, like they all the different fuels that they need, right? They have a big truck that will come and deliver them, right? 300, 400, 500 gallons in a shop, right? Okay. And so they do have a gas station at their house. Literally, they have a gas station at their house.
Yeah, good point. Okay.
Right. Right.
I'm and curious where you're going with this because that doesn't make sense.
And they're filling up combines and they're filling up trucks and they're filling up all the stuff, right?
All the implements. Yeah.
But a lot of these farmers, their homestead, their home, is either right next to their fields, adjacent to their fields, or within a couple of miles of their fields. And they are towing big, heavy things, 10,000, 8,000-pound things. They're towing them a couple miles. Not a couple hundred miles. A couple miles.
Okay.
And I'm going to use just today's technology, not even like 4 years from now technology, right? But if you had an F-150 Lightning that had 300 miles of range, and you towed something that's 6,000 pounds, 4 miles down the road, let's call it 10 miles because you got to go down the 5-mile gravel path and then you go down the actual road.
Okay.
And then you sit and you idle all day in the field to keep the car cool so your lunch stays cool or whatever. Who cares, right? Or so you guys can take a break in the truck because it's hot out. Using gas, but energy. Then you drive home. A, you didn't use that much energy in your vehicle at all if you had an electric vehicle. And two, because you didn't go anywhere. And two, instead of buying 500 gallons of gasoline, which you still have to buy gasoline until you buy electric tractors and all these other things, right?
Sure.
You plug in your truck at the barn or the side of the house or your garage or wherever you want to park. And the next morning, you're full. You're not driving that far. Now, this isn't every farmer. Some farmers are taking their cows all the way in to get slaughtered, and it's hundreds of miles. But by the way, most people don't live 100 miles from their butcher or their slaughterhouse.
True.
They live 30 miles from their slaughterhouse to their butcher.
In which case, 40 miles. The EV would still work.
Not a problem.
Like you said before, if you're hauling, you know, 20 head of cattle, torque is pretty nice on demand.
Instant torque, when you have 100% of it at zero, and you're not going 0 to 80, you're going 0 to 40. Now, hang on. When you have a lot of cattle or something that's lying behind you, you don't want to, like, rush off the line. Obviously.
You're going to the slaughter anyways, Joel. Come on. Let's give him a ride. Let's give him a ride one last time.
But
0 to 60.
So hang on. Those farmers are going to be, Joel, you can't take my truck. Like, you can't take my gun.
Right. Yes.
Nobody's coming to take any of their shit. But guess what? Do you know how much gas I go through sitting idling in a field all day? If you just unplugged your truck and drove it to the field, then you drove it back home, and you only had to charge it three times a week?
You're right, because that is going, like, to be the mindset and the attitude of, you know, come
it's
pry
so
it from
dumb,
my
though. It's
hand.
Just like they don't
but
think about it.
Here's the thing. Neighbor farmer Joe's ranch, he's going to get the new electric F-150.
And then he's going to go to lunch with Tom. And Tom is going to get
Tom is
going to
be like, it's going to make sense.
No, Tom's going to side-eye Bill. You got a $100,000 pickup? That's a pretty nice write-off.
Yep.
Like, and by the way, this is all today's battery tech.
Yeah.
8 years from now, when we're talking about solid-state batteries and stuff that don't have rare earth minerals, they're not nearly as bad to produce, they don't have degradation like today's.
Are we
going
to be able to build batteries that don't take rare earth minerals?
I mean, someday. I mean, hang on. I presume, dude, we're making seats and cars out of soybeans. We built the New York subway. When we want to, we can build great things.
Okay. That seems like a weird analogy. It's very dirty and.
It's something that's been bothering me lately. Like, I was talking to someone about how, like, we have built Manhattan and we built, like, all these skyscrapers and we built the New York subway. And I was like, could you imagine our society coming together to build something like that today? Never. Everyone would argue about politics and where the money's coming from. Never happen.
Yeah, you're right.
We used to be a society that built great things.
Well, we're going to Mars thanks to Elon Musk, but that was
sure we are. Can we send him to Mars? Horrible human being.
All right, and short of it, Joel Fetter says no one is coming for our keys. Gasoline will still be around. And even if, for whatever reason, you cannot get, you know, regular gasoline as regularly, one thing that's interesting and I want to do a totally different episode on are e-fuels or these new
That's a whole different topic. That's very interesting. We talked about that at dinner last night.
Right.
But that could be a market that
fills the gap.
You skipped over one thing that I think people need to understand.
Okay.
Not only is no one coming for your gas-powered car, legitimately no one's coming for this, right? And maybe downtown Manhattan, downtown Chicago, follow, you know, certain European cities where, like, Monday through Friday, you have to have a certain tag if you want to be in the city with a gas-powered car.
Joel, do you know who was just on this episode before you?
A lawyer who probably said, all that's never going to happen.
Yes, more or less. He said it's going to be based on jurisdiction. It will never be a federal mandate. So
100%. But just like everything else in this country, because we can't get it together. But whatever. My point here is, I just want everyone to understand, in some magic universe where 2030 or 2035, which is 7 years or 12 years.
Whatever.
Come around, and suddenly, all of a sudden, no gas-powered cars are sold. New.
Right.
right then and there. I just, you know, by the way, make believe world. Okay. I'm not entirely convinced that will happen. I'm not 100% convinced I will say it's going to happen. I think a lot of it, honestly, will be kind of dictated by the next election, frankly. That's just my honest opinion here. I think that
We won't go into politics.
There's some variables,
but
I think there's some variables here that will roll into that. But in Magic World, that happens, and literally no new gas powered cars sold at that point. You need to understand. Everyone listening to this needs to understand. The average car on the road today in America, today, is 11 and a half years old. That's a decade from now, almost.
Right.
It will take decades, and I mean
to phase
decades,
everything out,
for gas-powered cars to not be on the roads, mass market, blah, 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 to work itself out. It's just going to take a while. So the idea that anyone's coming, going to take them, they're just going to disappear, even from used car lots, is such a farce. It's not rooted in logic and data.
Right. And so there is still the argument or the theory that it's just going to be very expensive and you won't be able to get gas. Like, sure, diesel will exist because of, like you're talking about, over-the-road trucking. Here's an interesting thought that I haven't heard brought up. How many small community municipal airports have you seen? Like, how far is the closest airport to your house? It's not that far, right?
Eden Prairie.
Yes. My point is...
No, Medina.
Planes will always take gasoline, in my mind. My point is, you could always have access, even if they don't sell gasoline to consumers for your 300ZX. You could always, in theory, go to the airport and fill up. Because I know people that go to the airport right now and fill up their big block Chevy that has like 13-to-1 compression on AV gas.
Look,
because it needs it.
Rich people with their Paganis and Koenigseggs and Aventadors and Lamborghini Miuras. There will never... These are the same people, by the way, that can afford to buy a jet bike with a Rolls Royce engine and buy jet fuel by the pallet because that's what it drinks. Like,
there you go.
If you have the money...
Well,
probably also have a private plane, though.
Yes, that's the other part that Chris won't like, is that cars and antique cars will... internal combustion classic cars will become like equestrian hobbies. Like, it'll be
100%.
Potentially an expensive hobby or interest that only a few are able to cater to, and it takes additional infrastructure to support it.
There's an argument that I could make, and I want to be really careful here. There's an argument I can make that's already like that. There's two parts to this. There's the Chris Clewell, and he buys a derelict, lovely, patinaed, red Benz that who the F knows if it even runs because who has a key
for yes.
whatever amount of pocket change he gave some guy off the street to get it to his house.
Okay.
And he goes and dumpster dives in parts yards in Bumble ever and gets stuff. And he sits there cursing because he finds things in the engine. There's that part of the hobby today.
Okay.
Then there's the other guy who's on Bring a Trailer buying $130,000 Porsche 911s that look a whole lot like Chris's.
Yeah. What's your point?
Also, my point is that I'm not so convinced that you just painted a picture where it's like this equestrian hobby that's already pricing people out. I'm not so convinced we're not there. An old Mopar shell.
Yeah.
It's like 30 grand.
Yeah.
Like, a nice
Mopar.
You're
not making the argument
for yourself here. It's like $100,000.
Because that is, you're right. It is already abhorrently expensive on part of this hobby.
Like Chris's 911 was worth, when I bought my M5, I was looking at 911s. I wanted a 911. My wife said, it's two doors. We're going to have kids. And I said, I'll sell it. She said, no, you won't. We're getting a fight. She was probably right. And whatever. So I bought the M5. So I would have bought something like Chris's car, probably 18 grand-ish, throwing around numbers that were about that time.
Yeah.
The car's worth like $100,000 now.
Yeah. I know.
So to the idea that people can just get into the hobby Chris's engine, I think he was just on Instagram saying today, guys, I can't buy all these cars. I'm broke.
Yeah.
The reason Chris is broke, he just put a new engine in his 911 because it's a cheap hobby. That.
Correct.
Right, but it's not a cheap hobby is my point. So the idea that Chris lives in this fantasy world where this is later going to be some equestrian hobby where only the rich can play, we're there, baby.
Oh. Hmm.
Like, you're not going to buy a 911 like Chris. I think Chris sent me one from Bring a Trailer that went for like 180 grand or 130 grand. And I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah,
that's not a $130,000 car.
No, not really.
I mean, hang on. It's worth whatever one someone will pay, right?
I know, but like, the driving experience isn't that.
But we know it's not a $130,000 car. It's a $20,000 car. But now everybody wants one. And so they're all paying this because it's market value now.
Okay, so coming full circle, the state of the future of motoring freedom is no one's going to take away your keys. It won't be illegal to drive them. There will always be gas available, but it's going to be expensive.
And I already feel like it is expensive. But like,
yeah.
And everything's relative, right? Like, the amount of money I pay now for food, for groceries, or to go out to eat, for anything. It's crazy what everything life costs now, right? At the same time, we do it to ourselves. Because if you look at, like, our cell phones, our computers, our watches. By the way, when I was a kid, a Rolex was expensive. It's not what it is today, though. It's a whole different level of expensive. I just picked a random watch, to be clear. But, like, you know what I'm saying here.
I know.
When I was a kid, Rolexes were the stuff of very expensive things. But they weren't, oh, you're rich. They're expensive now.
I know. It's like those damn 911 drivers have them.
So that's not why I went there. But
no. Anyways,
look, automotive is an expensive hobby. So I grew up watching Home Improvement with my dad. Like, that's the era I grew up with, right?
Yeah.
And during that show, Tim Allen in the show had a hot rod. It was a Ford hot rod or whatever, right? And throughout the show, over time, he built the hot rod with his kids and his wife.
I remember
and, like,
this.
The kids, right? I grew up with that show, and when I got married, I had these big dreams that I would buy like an old Mopar that was like kind of derelict or whatever. And then over the years in the garage, just before the Z's
build it
and all
up
these things, by the way,
kids.
Like turns.
Yeah, yeah.
That with my kids over time, we'd build it. And then when they turned 16, we'd go for a drive and all these things are really cool. I can't afford to go buy an old derelict Mopar now. All these old boomers are like, I should have never sold my Mopar. So I've got money now. So I'm going to drop 100 grand on a GTX, which just sold for literally like 110 grand on Bring a Trailer the other day. And I'm like, what the hell? That is not a $100,000 car.
Well, it is now, apparently. No,
so this is the equestrian hobby we've now entered already.
You're right. Rich people and their damn horses, Joel. That's all we are.
Rich people and their horses with motors.
All right, Joel Fetter.
This is fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be sure to chat soon as well. All right, guys, we will be back next week with Chris, back from the road, talk about Luftekuhl and his adventure across the country. Take care.